All right, so let's say you're just browsing online, maybe looking for some new legal cases or something, and all of a sudden some illegal content pops up.
Oh, yeah.
You close it right away, like anyone would.
Right.
Like, what happens if what you accidentally saw was child pornography? Would you be considered a criminal just for seeing it for a second?
Well, that's exactly the kind of question that we're going to try to answer in this deep dive by looking at the case of State v. Barger.
Okay.
This case went all the way up to the Oregon Supreme Court.
Wow.
And it really makes us think about how digital technology is impacting our legal system, especially when it comes to defining something like possession in the digital
I
age.
knew this one would be complicated, but wow, it's even more nuanced than I expected. So, okay, we're talking about Barry Barger, who was already being investigated.
Right.
So the police searched his computer, and by the way, they had his wife's consent to do it, which I think is a whole other can of
Oh,
worms.
yeah, absolutely.
But anyway, they find these images of child pornography, but there's a catch.
Yeah. The catch is how the police found those images. They weren't just like in a folder, They were what we called cached images.
Okay, so for our listeners who might not be tech wizards, what exactly does cached mean?
So basically, whenever someone looks at a website, their browser, like Chrome or Firefox or Safari,
Right.
it automatically saves like temporary copies of images and files. It does that. So the next time you visit that website, things load faster.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, and these copies are called cached files. But the thing is, the user doesn't actually do anything to save or download these images. They just sort of end up on their computer and they might not even know they're there.
So the prosecution was trying to say that just because those images were in the cache on his computer, that he possessed them.
Exactly. They were saying that because those images were there, technically he could have like printed them or emailed them or whatever. So they were claiming that just having the ability to do something with the images meant that he possessed them even if he never actually did anything with them.
Well, I mean, I can access all sorts of things online, but I wouldn't say I possess them.
And that's exactly what the defense argued.
Okay.
They basically said, hold on a second. There's absolutely no evidence that Barger intentionally saved those pictures or did anything with them.
Right.
It's like saying that you possess every billboard that you drive by just because technically you could stop and take a picture of it.
Okay, that's a good analogy. So this whole case really comes down to whether just looking at child pornography online and having those temporary cached files, accidentally created is legally the same as if someone like actually had it in their possession.
Yes, exactly. The Oregon Supreme Court had to decide if passive viewing that leads to those temporary files actually fits the definition of possession,
Yeah.
according to Oregon law.
Okay, I'm all ears. What did the court decide? Did they agree with the prosecution's broad definition of possession, or did they side with the defense?
The majority of the court actually ended up siding with Barger. Their opinion, which was written by Justice Gillette, said that just looking at something online without taking any further action is not enough to say that someone possessed it.
Wow, okay. So break it down for me. Why did they decide that? What was their reasoning?
So first they looked at what the law actually intended to do.
Okay.
They said that when this law was written, lawmakers were mainly focused on going after people who like actively get and store child pornography.
Right.
They weren't trying to punish people for something that their web browser just does automatically in the background.
So it wasn't just about what the law literally said, but also about understanding what the lawmakers are trying to do with this law.
Exactly. And the court was very worried about something called overcriminalization.
Okay.
Basically, they said, imagine if just seeing something online without doing anything else was enough to get you arrested.
Oh, wow.
I mean, that would mean that anyone who uses a computer could theoretically be considered guilty of something. It would
Yeah.
be total chaos.
Yeah, that sounds like a slippery slope that could get really out of hand.
Yeah, and the court saw that slippery slope too. They recognize that the internet is just inherently different from, the physical world.
Right.
Content appears and disappears really fast, and sometimes we don't have a ton of control over what we see, like with those targeted ads that follow you everywhere online.
Ugh, tell me about it. So they were basically saying that the digital world doesn't always fit neatly into our existing legal categories.
Exactly. This case really forced the court to confront that issue head on. But wait, there's another piece to this puzzle that we need to talk about.
Oh, there's more.
Well,
Don't leave me hanging.
there was also a dissenting opinion in this case written by Justice Kistler, and he had a very different take on this whole question of possession in the digital world.
Okay, this is getting good. Tell me, what did Justice Kistler disagree with?
Well, Kistler said that if someone intentionally went looking for child pornography, that should be enough to show that they had control over it and therefore that they possessed it. He said that it doesn't matter if they saved the images or not. The very fact that they deliberately searched for this kind of content means that they already crossed a line.
So in his view, it all comes down to intent.
Exactly. Kistler was worried that the majority opinion was creating a loophole that people could exploit.
How so?
Well, he was afraid that people who know a lot about technology would use this like fine line between viewing and possessing to get away with looking at this illegal stuff, even though they were deliberately searching for it.
So it becomes this debate about where you draw the line between a thought crime and an actual crime that you can be punished for, especially when you're talking about something as serious as child pornography.
You got it. And this question of intent in the digital age is only going to get more and more important as technology keeps changing.
I'm starting to see how important this State v. Barger case really is.
Yeah.
It makes us rethink some really fundamental legal ideas because of this new digital world that we live in.
Absolutely. And what this case means goes way beyond just this one specific situation. It's a decision that could change how we think about digital evidence, online privacy, and even criminal intent in the future.
Well, we've already covered a lot of ground, but I think there's still more to talk about here.
You're absolutely right. We've only just scratched the surface of this complex case and everything it means.
Can't wait to dig deeper.
Me too.
All right, let's get into it.
So we know that this case really comes down to how the court defined what possession actually means in the digital age. And to really get all the little details, I think it would help if we looked closer at the specific legal stuff that both the majority opinion and the dissenting opinion used.
Okay, yeah, let's break down those legal arguments. What were the key things that made the court side with Barger? I mean, what were they really focused on?
Well, one of the biggest arguments the majority opinion made was about something called legislative intent. They like really dug deep into the exact words of the Oregon law that makes possessing child pornography illegal. And they decided that the lawmakers who wrote it were mainly going after people who like try to get and keep these bad materials on purpose.
So they're saying it's not enough to just see it online for a second. You have to actually make an effort to get it and keep it for it to count as possession.
Right, exactly. The court really separated actively possessing something versus passively viewing it. They said that the law wasn't written to punish people for content that just ends up on their computer without them knowing about it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. The internet is full of surprises. It wouldn't be fair to blame someone for every single image or video that pops up, especially with all the spam and weird links that can send you to places you never wanted to go.
Exactly. And the court seemed to get that. They knew that in the digital age, we're constantly getting information thrown at us and we don't always have control over what we see. They wanted to make a clear difference between intentionally having something, which means you did something on purpose to get it, and just seeing it, which could happen by accident.
So they said you can't punish someone for something their web browser does without them knowing. It's not like Barger specifically chose to save those pictures.
Exactly. The court said that those cache files were created without him doing anything. They even compared it to someone blaming you for having a flyer stuck to your shoe as you're walking down the street.
Okay, I can see that. So just because you have something on your computer doesn't automatically mean you possess it, legally speaking.
Right. But of course, you know, it's the Supreme Court, so there has to be a dissenting opinion. Justice Kistler didn't agree with any of this.
Okay, so tell me, what did Justice Kistler think was wrong with the majority opinion?
Well, his dissent was all about culpability. He thought that if someone looks for child pornography on purpose, that shows that they have some level of criminal intent, whether or not they actually save the images.
So he's saying that even just looking for and viewing that content for a little while is enough to show that you're in control of it, and that means you're possessing it.
Exactly. Kistler was worried that the majority opinion would create a loophole.
A loophole? What do you mean?
He was afraid that people who were really good with computers would use this like gray area between viewing and possessing to get away with looking at this illegal stuff, even though they were looking for it on purpose.
So it becomes a question of the letter of the law versus the spirit of the law. We have the majority focused on whether someone actually saved the content, and then the dissent focused on the intent behind viewing it, saying that looking for this content is a crime in itself.
You said it perfectly. And this debate is even harder when you think about how hard it is to prove what someone was thinking online. Like, how can you really know what someone was thinking when they clicked on a link or searched for something? It's not always obvious.
I see how this would make things tougher for prosecutors. They can't just say, oh, look, there's a cached file and call it a day. Mm-hmm. Now they have to prove that someone did something on purpose and that they meant to do it.
Exactly. This case has definitely changed what counts as enough evidence in these child pornography cases. Prosecutors can't just show that the content was on the computer. They have to show that the person went looking for it on purpose and had some kind of control over it, even if they didn't save it permanently.
This is making me rethink how I look at digital evidence in my own cases. It's not as simple as I thought. It's more than just looking at what's there.
Right.
You have to think about what it really means about what the person did and what they were thinking.
That's a really important thing for anyone working with digital evidence to remember. The State v. Barger case shows us that we can't just apply old legal ideas to new technologies without thinking about all the details of the digital world. The rules have changed, and we need to change our strategies and how we think about these things.
So we've talked about the legal stuff and how hard it is to prove what someone meant to do online. But what does this all mean for the average person? How does a case like this with such a specific and sensitive issue affect our everyday lives and how we use the internet?
Yeah, that's the big question, isn't it? How do we manage this digital trail that follows us everywhere online?
Yeah.
It can feel kind of impossible.
Yeah, it really does. So give me some hope here. What are some things we can actually do? What's the digital version of shredding your old documents and not giving out your personal information?
Well, one of the easiest and most important things you can do is just check your privacy settings regularly, on social media, email, and all those other online services you use. It's surprising how many people just stick with the default settings without even knowing what they're sharing and who can see it.
Ugh, yeah, I'm definitely guilty of that. I just click accept on those privacy policies without reading them. It's so tempting to just skip over them. But it sounds like that's a bad idea.
It happens to a lot of people, but it really is worth taking a minute to figure out what you're agreeing to. Those privacy policies can be super long and boring, but try to pay attention to stuff like how they collect data, how they use those cookies to track what you do, and if they share your data with other companies.
Okay, so lesson one, read the fine print. What else can we do to be more careful about our digital footprint?
Another thing is to be really careful about what links you click on and what websites you visit. Watch out for emails or messages that look sketchy, especially if they ask for personal information or try to send you to weird websites. It's kind of like the online version of don't talk to strangers. Only go to websites, and trust, and be extra careful about downloading stuff from places you don't recognize.
That's good advice. It's so easy to just click on stuff without thinking. But it sounds like being careful online is really important.
Yeah, it really is. The internet can be an amazing tool, but it's important to remember that there are risks too. You need to be aware of those risks and protect yourself.
So besides being careful about what we click and checking our privacy settings, are there other things we can do to protect our privacy online? Are there any proactive things we can do?
There are some really cool tools out there that can help. Have you ever heard of a VPN?
I've heard of it, but I don't really know what it is or how it works. Mm-hmm. What's a VPN?
So basically, a VPN is like a secret tunnel that your internet traffic goes through.
Okay.
It hides your IP address and your location, so it looks like you're browsing from somewhere else.
Mm.
This is really good for keeping your information private, especially when you're using public Wi-Fi, which can be less secure than your home network.
So it's like a disguise for your internet activity. That's pretty cool.
Exactly. And there are other tools you can use too. You can get a password manager to help you make and remember really strong passwords for all your accounts. And ad blockers can get rid of those annoying ads that follow you around. And if you really care about privacy, you might even want to try a special web browser that's built for protecting your data. There are tons of options out there. It's all about finding what works best for you.
Wow, this is a lot to think about. It sounds like staying safe online takes a lot of work, and you really have to pay attention.
It can feel a little overwhelming at first, but the trick is to just start small. Make little changes to how you use the internet. Start using some of these tools slowly, and over time, you'll get better at protecting yourself online.
So it's like a marathon, not a sprint. I'm feeling a lot better now that I understand the risks and what I can do to stay safe.
That's what we want here at The Deep Dive. We want to give you the information you need to make smart choices online.
Well, you've done a great job. This whole deep dive into State v. Barger has been really eye-opening. I'm definitely thinking differently about the internet, how I use it, and how what we do online can have real consequences in the real world.
That's exactly why we do this. We want to get people talking about these issues and help them understand how to use the internet safely and responsibly.
So as we wrap up this episode, what's the most important thing you want our listeners to remember? What's the biggest lesson we can learn from this case?
I think the most important thing to remember from State v. Barger is that even though the internet is huge and always changing, it's not like a lawless place. The same legal rules that apply to us offline also apply online, but the digital world has its own special challenges, especially when it comes to things like privacy, what people meant to do, and what counts as evidence.
It's a good reminder that what we do online isn't separate from our real lives. We have to be careful, think ahead, and be willing to change how we do things.
Exactly. The internet is constantly changing, and so are the laws and rules that apply to it. If we stay curious, keep learning, and are willing to adapt, we can all use the internet safely and responsibly.
Well said. This has been another amazing deep dive into the complicated world of law technology and how they affect our lives. Thanks for being here.
It was great to be here. Until next time, stay curious, stay informed, and stay safe online.